and then finally we headed into entomology and to see if there was a use in that area. So we took a look at the user requirements that we interviewed some people. We actually went down, spoke to people at the Smithsonian. Some of the user requirements for doing 3D images were, first of all, it had to be easy to use. Nobody wanted to be sitting around for hours trying to figure out how to get a nice three-dimensional rotational image. Safety of the sample was critical, because when you're imaging in 3D, you're actually moving the sample while you're moving the optics. It's a little bit of a dance, and you'll get a chance to see that in a moment. Sample size is an issue. You know, certainly I have a hard time rotating under a microscope a specimen that's 5 to 7 inches long. So it really doesn't work for some of the larger specimens as well. What's the fluidity of the image? How fluid is that image that you're going to see? Are you going to see a shaky move from frame to frame, which you would have seen even only a year or two ago? But now with these quad-core processors, you really can get a nice 24 frame to 30 frame per second image. And that's really what you need. Actually, the lower limit is probably 14 to 15 frames per second is a fluid enough image not to get you dizzy or to get your stomach upset. The gold standard would be 30 frames per second. But remember, each frame is going to be 2 to 5 megs. So a single second of video on a system like this is 25 to 35 meg for each second of video. Okay. Diffuse lighting in a 3D world is very important, because as you're turning the sample, the light has to be tracking the sample at the same time. And the new dome lighting, those kinds of diffuse lightings work very well. The problem is, if I'm moving the optics, I also have to be moving that dome light at the same time. And then we can also create overlays for comparison purposes even while we're shooting a movie. Okay. The next user requirement is, people said, well, if we're looking at a 3D image, we'd like that image to really display kind of texture. That's one of the benefits of having the moving video. You know, if I hold my hand up like this, and you're all looking at it, okay, I can create a 3D image by just starting to turn it, okay? And that image is what you'll see creating the texture in some of the samples you'll see. Sample manipulation. The system, we felt, needed to be accurate to within 1 to 5 microns as far as the movement of the table, so that you could return to any point as you were manipulating a specimen. You should be able to return that specimen to any given point within, as I said, 1 to 5 microns. How do you go backwards? P. Okay. The ability to share the images was also extremely important to all the users we spoke to, and they didn't want people to have any special equipment. So if you were looking at the images in Paris, you don't need to don special goggles to see this 3D type imaging. A full suite of measurement tools, and that's also a sticking point, because if you're viewing a specimen and you're rotating it, you know, a standard measurement of an angle isn't going to mean a lot to you, or a point-to-point measurement, depending if you're looking, you know, down the tail of the insect as opposed to looking at the tail sideways. You have a bunch of issues with measurement as well when you're dealing in a 3D world. Also, we wanted to come up with a fully automated way. People said, we don't want to spend a lot of time. If we're imaging a sample in 3D, the entire process should take under 5 minutes. From the moment we mount the specimen to when we have a 3D image, if we could do that in 5 minutes, that would be a very acceptable time frame. But if my students or I myself am sitting there for 2 hours trying to get a single 3D video, that's not going to work for us. And finally, you know, multi-plane images have to be part of this equation as well. One of the things we're currently working on is the ability to do a multi-plane movie. So basically, every frame is a multi-plane image. Okay. What you see at the lower right there is the controller. It's kind of like an Xbox controller controlling these myriad of motors. I think The current version, the current prototype we here have here at the show, there is, I think there's 11 motors controlling the positional accuracy of the equipment. And those are all controlled with that box there. Though the user only has to press a single button on that box to image the entire specimen. We also found out that we thought you were using the same pin sizes. And thank God no one had trusted us with any samples, because suddenly when we were rotating one of the samples upside down, it just kind of dropped out. And I said, what is that? You know, so that was a little, that was a shock. And then someone said, oh, by the way, we noticed you're using a magnetic holder, a magnetic chuck to hold it. How do you handle brass with that? And we went, you guys use brass? They said, well, and certainly in some of the older specimens. So we've now had to go back and redesign a new holder that will hold those. It's also important, if possible, for those pins to be straight, because we're turning the sample. And if it's like this, all of a sudden, you know, we're checking all of our optics, saying, why does that not work for us, you know? And so, so there are some limitations. You want the pins to be straight. And it would also be nice, I know this isn't always possible, if you could pierce it through the center of the effect. That's another story. I don't want to go there, but that's where we need some of your help, because we think for the cases where 3D makes sense, we do have to look at other ways for you to mount your specimens. Okay. So again, to the right you see the specimen positioner, and that has two motors in it. There's probably not a point. Let me use this. Okay. These two blue bars here, those are aluminum, and as this turns, those bars prevent the lens from coming down and hitting your specimen that's sitting in the center. So we have three layers of containment for your specimen. One is software. We never allow the lens to get closer to your specimen. And every time we move this positioner, we move the lens up and then move it back into position. And so you have some hard stops, and you also have software protection for your specimen. Rotating a sample, really 2 inches is about as large as we currently want to go. One of the problems is the larger specimens, when you're rotating them in 3D, tend to kind of fly or turn. You know, they have issues with weight, actually, at that size. So below 2 inches is really what we found to work the best. And if we don't use the rotator, we also have rotating optics. And when you just use rotating optics, there's no limit to the size that your specimen can be, but we have to image it on a flat surface. Okay. So again, the gold standard for full motion video in 3D is 30 frames per second. Movies are shot typically at 24 frames per second, and usable is 13 to 15 frames per second. When viewing movies made in 3D, you want to be using what they call an Ultra XGA monitor, or a 16 by 1200 monitor. That's the best resolution you can get, and that's not a typical monitor you'd see at Costco. So if you check that, that's pretty much what you want to use when viewing these 3D movies. The displaying of the motion itself will give you the texture, and actually taking the slide out, but there are features that allow you to do overlays, so you can overlay one image on top of another and compare those two images. And again, you can do this while you're doing it in 3D. So let's start to take a look at some of the images. This was just what's unusual about this image is we never touched the specimen once to get all those different images. Those were all generated, and the time for generating that entire collage of images was about 7 seconds. So we mounted the specimen once, touched a single button, and it produced that. Now, this is not a multi-sliced or multi-paned image, multi-planed image, but it could just as easily have been, and it probably would have added probably another 60 seconds to the process. I'm going to go ahead a little bit. This is a little more technical on how we're actually moving the sample. We're using servo controls. They're a little more accurate than stepper motors. They're inherently safer. They've got increased positional accuracy. So if you're going to design your own 3D imaging system, tend to use servo motors in the process if you decide to, if you're crazy enough to decide to do this. Also, I mentioned here for sharing these 3D images, the internet is almost ready, and that could be 10 years away or 5 years, I'm not sure, but bandwidth for these large files is still a huge issue. Matter of fact, it was even an issue today getting this presentation to run because the images were crashing the system. So these large files, and you can't use a lot of compression or you'll lose the detail, and in your world it's all about the detail. Typically, even in 3D, we would like that full set of analysis tools. And why automate? I think one of the reasons you'd want to automate this process is, again, to do it manually is basically impossible. So automation is actually the only way to go for 3D imaging. You have no other choice, because you certainly aren't going to sit there and turn these samples by hand. It's just not going to happen. Very repeatable. It also, there's a note here for remote access. One of our goals would be to have these, because these can be operated completely tele-remotely, so you can have the ability to have this sitting in Australia, the same one, ask someone to mount a sample, and you would be able to take over control here. And that's currently available. That's not kind of something in the future. That's a very easy process. Now, getting the full images back is different. There's what the current unit looks like. You'll notice on either side of it are micromanipulators. Those manipulators allow you to actually access the sample and manipulate the sample. They move it you can control the movement down to about 5 microns a second, so you have a lot of control over your sample. And let me just get right to some of the images. We did a survey as well. The survey was just to see whether students preferred moving images over stationary ones. There's three types of movements here. This shows just the optics moving around a sample. Okay? And it's actually a very fluid image, but the computers here can't keep up with the speed. They don't have quad processors here. So that's one. Here's another one where we just decided to look at this side to side. Now, the top image, that's dual rotation. So we're going to go from the top of that specimen, come all the way around. Now, if we'd had enough processing power, I can go completely around that specimen in one shot. And that's what we're now working on doing with a multi-plane image, so that you can stop that image at any point in time and drill down, zoom in, and still have the type of resolution that you would think. This is just what it looks like just spinning the sample and not the optics. And you can really see the difference between that. This next one is the one we saw before, where you're turning the optics around the sample. And then finally, if we go back to this, compare again that image to the other two. Now, my lighting wasn't that good. I'm learning more and more about lighting. But I think you can see the advantages of that type of 3D image. Okay. So the end is just what's next, and we're available for people to just talk to about this. We have a booth, so if you have any input and things you'd like to see us working on, that would be great. And any questions?
And I'll show you one or two of those. And they're also, I imagine, predator pairs, but I don't have any examples of those. So what I'm going to do now is show some pictures of these. And I need to explain that a lot of these pictures are faded and drab because these specimens have been sitting out in my lab for at least a year and a half. Jane took the pictures and did her very best, and while she was doing her very best, I could hear her muttering under her breath things that I refused to listen to. So let me go through a few of these. This is a pericard on the left and a red Davidian. By the way, if you want the full identification of these, the full determination of these, email me and I'll send you the species. I don't have them here. A pericard on the left and a red Davidian on the right. African. Wow. Pericard on the left, Ropalid on the right, two herbivores. Pericard on the left, Regiviad on the right. Ropalid, Alepticorus on the left, Dysdercus, Pericard in the middle, and a Regiviad on the right. And finally, for this sequence, an elided, a rice bug, Leptocoryza on the left, and a Regiviad on the right. And in all cases, these occur, at least they occur in the same general area. I have no evidence that they actually occur together in close companionship. Now, there are, I think, several explanations for these similarities. One of them, I think, is poor, if not silly. The others are not incompatible with one another, and it's possible that, and I'm sure there are additional explanations, because I just sort of spun these off out of my somewhat disorganized mind. Let me dispose of the first one, the one that I think is unlikely. And this is the phenomenon that's known as aggressive mimicry, and basically aggressive mimicry says that a predator looks like a prey in order to sneak up on it and grab it. And it seems to me this is, to put it as gently as I can, unlikely. First of all, most important predators for insects, I think, are not other insects or other arthropods. I think they're most likely to be vertebrates, birds, reptiles, to some extent amphibians, and small mammals. And among the small mammals, particularly rodents, and I think it's no coincidence, the largest group of mammals are small rodents, which feed mostly on seeds and on arthropods. Second, most vertebrates use sight, at least in some part of their prey-catching activities. They get their prey at either the beginning or the end through sight. Aggressive mimicry assumes that arthropod predators look like their arthropod prey in order, as I mentioned, to sneak up on them and be unkind to them. And the assumption behind this is that arthropods see other arthropods the same way that vertebrates, including us, see arthropods. And I think that's, as I say, at best unlikely and at worst silly. I mentioned it's a weird notion. One proponent of aggressive mimicry was Breton, and in describing or explaining the similarity between a Phonarctonus species, a Regiviad, and a Dysdercus species, a Pericorid, he described it this way, and I won't repeat the German because I don't want Christiana to be embarrassed by laughing at my pronunciation, so this is my translation. Quote, apparently this is another case of aggressive mimicry. Under the mask of a friend, perhaps of a love-seeking Liebesuchende, conspecific, the Phonarctonus creeps up on the carefree, the word here is arglosen, which is sort of, I like to think of as happily innocent, the carefree Dysdercus, in order to rear above him, not for mating, but in order to bring to him the death-dealing stab. Den Toblingen den Stich. I think that's just lovely. And I wish I'd had time to make an image of this creeping up. And I like to think that it probably hums a gentle little love song. And then... anyway. Okay, so then if these things look alike, not because the predator is going to sneak up and amorously stab the prey, why do they look alike? Well, I think there are several possibilities, and one of them I think might be called group warning. That looking alike, to warn away sight-using predators, not by an individual's warning color, but by the mass of warning colors created by the gathering together of many similarly colored bugs. If this is reasonable, and I think it is, in fact I suggested this as an explanation for the aggregation of Parastrachia, and Lisa can tell me if I'm crazy. And if it's true that vertebrate predators are more important as predators of bugs, of insects, or at least of pteropters, if that's true, then it would be an advantage to everybody to have lots of same-colored aposematic bugs clustered together, warding off predators from a distance. And although even a few like-colored bugs together might be a deterrent, I would assume that the larger the mass of deterrent color, bright red or whatever, the better. Because the larger the mass of deterrent, the larger the deterrent mass, the greater the distance that the predator will stay. And the predator that stays far away does not kill as many insects as the predator that comes up close. And so a